Lectionary Lab Live is recorded in the studios of the 405 Oxford Group, Gainesville, Florida, and Brasstown, North Carolina, a Two Bubbas and a Bible production. Welcome, everybody, to the Lectionary Lab Live. I'm John Fairless. I'm here with my Bubba, Delmer Chilton. Say hey, Bubba.
Hey, Bubba.
Man, good to hear from you. We're getting ready to talk a little text today. We are preparing for the 17th Sunday after Pentecost. These are the texts for September the 20th, 2015. Finishing this stretch of the season where we don't have any particular holidays and everybody's back in the fall and this and that and the other. But good text today, Bubba. What you thinking about for preaching and such as that?
Well, there are several themes. I picked out kind of four different little things that one might could look at. One is suffering of the prophets. You know, you have Jeremiah talking about suffering and following, and Jesus is talking about suffering and following in Mark. So there's that. Both Jeremiah, the Psalm, and the Gospel playing off the same theme is that in the midst of our suffering or in the midst of following God and things not working out as well as we'd hoped, God can be trusted. So there's that. I think the Gospel lesson in particular talks a great deal about the difference between leadership and servanthood and how that works together. The whole issue of the greatest. And lastly, I think welcome has a great deal here with the child. I think you could work with whoever welcomes one such child in my name welcomes me, and whoever welcomes me welcoming, and the welcome all over the place there. And for some of us, welcome has become a little bit of an issue. Those of us who celebrate perhaps weekly Eucharist, the liturgical types, and, you know, how open is our table is a question that's come up. Particularly among Lutherans and Episcopalians and some others, because I was telling someone when I first started as a Lutheran pastor, the bulletin always said, any baptized Christian who believes in the real presence, you know, is welcome at the table. Right. That means you're a Lutheran.
Right.
And gradually it changed to any baptized Christian, to any Christian, to all are welcome. The issue is being raised, particularly around that, is the table for the baptized. And that's a discussion that's happening at that kind of Facebook, social media level. Now it's become a study in both the denominations. So this question, this welcoming children, how does one welcome? And what does welcome mean? And other traditions have open and closed issues. It may not be the table, it may be others. And as we talk about that hospitality of all are welcome, what does that mean?
Yeah, definitely plenty to jump into. And we're going to move on right back into Jeremiah. But it just strikes me as you raise the theme of suffering of the prophet. Suffering? I mean, he's talking about dying. We're talking about a lamb led to the slaughter. We're talking about, you know, again, last week, giving one's life for the gospel, taking up your cross, etc. So, yeah, maybe I want to push it a little more on suffering, farther even than suffering. I mean, this is about dying. This is about dying. And so, to me, the themes are of, we talked last week, giving your life away. Well, this is dying to self, dying for the gospel. That's good stuff. Let's talk about Jeremiah.
Well, in Jeremiah, this is a section that's sometimes called the Laments of Jeremiah, but I would have to say that they're really more like complaints.
Right.
A lament comes along after death. You know, you're lamenting what's happened, and there's nothing that can be done about it. A complaint in this game is he has grievances against God.
Right.
You know, but I was like a gentle lamb led to the slaughter. Who led him to the slaughter? He's saying God did. I did not know it was against me that they devised schemes, saying, you know, so this is, he's saying, man, you called me to preach. Little did I know
what I was in for.
And they let us destroy the tree with its fruit. Let us cut him off from the land of the living. So, isn't it? So, in other words, it's, they're after Jeremiah. They're after the messenger. And he says, help me. Help me. Mm-hmm. Jeremiah feels abandoned by God, tricked by God, let down by God, yet he continues to trust in God. You judge righteously. Try the heart and mind. Let me see your retribution upon them, for to you I have committed my cause. So there's this whole piece that the Bible teaches us is okay that sometimes we think's not okay.
Right.
Which is to say, this is not what I expected, and God's the one who did it. Martin Luther, you joke about my Luther pills, but he is so quotable. He said, yeah, we see the pastor walking down the street, and everybody says, good morning, Herr Pastor. Oh, how are you, Herr Pastor? And we see that. So I would like to do that. And then we get ordained and begin in a church, and the crap begins to fly, and it's too late. God tricks us into ministry because otherwise nobody would do it. He said that. Jeremiah might agree with it.
He might. And this goes deeper. It's an issue of call for all Christians. Certainly the suffering of the prophet and what the, you know, if you're going to speak in the name of the Lord, what you're accepting and what you're doing. But this is an opportunity to for all of us to consider the call to follow Christ, to give your life, to surrender your life. I grew up in this evangelical tradition, and the invitation hymn, boy, I can reel them off, and I've sung them 100 times. Take my life and let it be consecrated. Wherever he leads, I'll go, just as I am, without one plea. I surrender all. I mean, you know, week after week after week, we sing these hymns. And I remember an evangelist of my youth, one day sort of stopping the revival and the invitation at the end. He said, do you people realize what you're singing? Do you, you know, do you really mean it? Do you really surrender everything you are? It's easy to kind of characterize that and look at that and say, yeah, that's a little overzealous maybe. But what is the call to surrender one's life?
Well, one of the issues is, I think, and this happens in different denominations, different traditions, and different ways, is that American salesmanship comes in. And so we end up telling people their life will be better.
Right.
You know, you got all these things wrong with your life, and if you join the church, you know, it's like playing a country song backwards. You know, you get your dog back, your girlfriend returns, you know, you got the joke. Well, joining the church, getting saved, becoming a Christian, we have sold it as improving your life. And maybe it does, but that's not the key. The key is Christ is the King. Christ has died for our sake, and we are invited to come and follow and take up a cross. And the scripture is very clear to us, this doesn't necessarily improve our life in this world.
Right.
It changes our orientation toward who we are in life and what we're doing. And that's the issue. And Jeremiah speaks very clearly this issue, I think, to this issue of, I decided to follow God, and it didn't work out the way I wanted to, and he first blames God. Then he turns around and says, but I still trust God. And that's the place all of us have to move forward through to. And I always look at Jesus' baptism as an example. You know, Jesus comes and he says, you know, this is my beloved son in whom I'm well pleased. And then he sent the Holy Spirit to drive him into the wilderness to be tempted by Satan for 40 days. The themes are there for us to see that this is about not making your life easier. It's about making your life count more. That's in a different way.
Well, let's talk about how Psalm 54 might give us some language for that. It's basically an affirmation of faith. You know, the Lord upholds my life. Surely, even when I look around and I see everybody's against me and I see all this stuff happening, surely God is with me. God holds my life.
Well, this is Psalm 54 is a prayer of one who feels they have been persecuted wrongly.
Right.
Traditionally, this is believing that David wrote these psalms. This has to do with Saul's persecution of David. They're in Samuel's story, so you can do that. And it shifts in who's talking to whom back and forth between the prayer, praying to God, and then occasionally proclaiming to the people he's talking to. Right. So it goes a little bit back and forth. So verses 1 through 3 are a prayer. And then verse 4 and 5, the first part of 5, is a proclamation to who's listening, see, God is my helper, et cetera, et cetera. Then it shifts back 5B through the first part of the 7 to prayer, and it ends with proclamation again. And it's when praying that God, one of the things we have trouble with, I think, now is praying that God destroys your enemies when Jesus tells us, love your enemies and forgive them.
Right.
That's a difficulty for us. So I just put it in the category of hyperbole and leave it alone. These are the people bothering, destroy them, take care of them, get rid of them.
God's going to have to sort all this out.
This goes with that kind of Jeremiah complaint against God issue at one point, 1-2. Help me. Help me, God. Hear my prayer. Give word, for strangers have risen up against me. This is why I need your help. But then he turns to that shift, that statement of faith. God's my helper. God will sustain me. I'll be fine. Then asking for destroy the enemy, which is get rid of this bad thing in my life. And 6 is a vow of thanks. I will offer you a free will sacrifice and praise your name, O Lord, for it is good. I've struggled with this because it's one of those questions, is this bargaining with God? Right. And we talk about, you don't want people to bargain with God. If you let my brother live, I'll serve you forever and all that kind of thing. But I don't think so.
Right.
I think this is more along the lines, he doesn't say, if you do this for me, then I will offer a sacrifice.
Right.
I think it says, I will continue to offer the sacrifice. I trust whatever happens. I will continue to worship you.
Right.
For you have rescued me, see in 7, you have rescued me from every trouble. That's past tense. The rest of it's future tense. So he says, you've always rescued me. I trust you now. I make my offering. It's in your hands.
Yeah. When I think about this psalm and what it's talking about, I'm reminded, like many others, I love to read Anne Lamott. I've read her for years. And I think the first work I ever read of hers was Traveling Mercies. And she tells the story in there of learning from a friend of hers what she now calls her two favorite prayers. First one is, help me, help me, help me. And the second one is, thank you. And that's, to me, kind of catches the tone of what's going on here. Lord, help me, help me. I'm in trouble here, and I thank you because you're going to take care of it. This overwhelms me, and life is overwhelming. All right, James. We've been a few weeks in James now. Who is wise and understanding among you? Let's talk about James.
Well, James is again talking to his early church community, the one there in Jerusalem. And he's trying to sort through some things. So one of the things that I always like to think about when you're reading the epistles is realizing that we are hearing one half of a conversation. It's like listening to somebody talk on the phone and trying to imagine what's being said back to them on the other side. So apparently he's dealing with some conflicts and disputes among you. Where do they come from? Chapter 4, verse 1. And he said they come from what's at war within yourself. So he talks about what is wisdom and knowledge. The difference between wisdom and knowledge, I think, is an important place to go here. And I had a neighboring pastor's wife, the pastor at the Free Methodist Church, and I don't remember her name, but he was saying, yeah, she always says that knowledge is knowing that a tomato is a fruit. Wisdom is knowing not to put tomatoes in your fruit salad. I kind of like that.
Yeah.
But wisdom is discerning what's important. Another way of putting it is knowledge is knowing stuff.
Right.
And wisdom is knowing what stuff's important.
What's important. And what do you do with the knowledge?
And wisdom for James results in a good life. And so this is one of the issues there is wisdom is not knowledge. It's not this great accumulation of facts. I've had too much education, some people would say, been in too many schools and multiple degrees and some good universities and some, regular schools, et cetera, et cetera. And I've known a lot of people with doctoral degrees. But I'd have to say the wisest person I ever knew was my grandmother, who was very proud that she never missed a day of school. Went 100 days a year for 11 straight years.
Right.
Her knowledge was not extensive. Her wisdom was great.
Right.
And that's the difference. And wisdom for James results in a good life, not a happy or wealthy life, but a peaceable, gentle, yielding mercy and good fruits. She knew what was important. Yeah. That, I think, is what he calls wisdom.
Yeah. And which of us now is, we accumulate years like your grandmother did and some other wise people. I agree. My grandfather, I think, still counts as the wisest person I've ever known. You begin to see it's really true. These are the things that do count. And a lot of us would give a pretty considerable pile of money to have a little more peace, a little more gentleness in our lives,
right,
a little more mercy, and you know, lack of partiality and hypocrisy. Oh my, that'd be a good world to live in. So,
well, I would say that contrary to the good life is a bad life, which comes not from wisdom, but from being a wise guy.
A wise guy, yeah.
You know, in quotes, you know, and now you can play with that. But you know, all these things about this conflict, you know, these people that say, I will not be, you know, I'll take care of me and mine, and I'm too, you know, you're too, we sometimes talk about being too smart for your own good. You never trust anybody. You're always at war with the world. I got to stand up for me. I'm not going to let anybody get anything over on me, et cetera, et cetera. That's the kind of stuff, cravings that are at war within you. You want something, do not have it, so you commit murder. You covet something, cannot obtain it. So what the world calls being smart is what he's talking about, is that which drives the lack of peace and is unwise.
Yeah. I just want to mention real quickly, I remember this from my youth group days, and one of those things that sticks with you, the ending of this passage, the ending of chapter 4 that we have today, wonderful wisdom on prayer, and you know, and of course this great verse, drawing near to God and God drawing near to you. You and I were talking right before the show about some reading and other stuff we've been doing about getting quieter and how the world's so loud, we just get very little chance to slow down and stop. But I remember one of my youth group leaders, you know, talking about the quick list of things here that can affect your prayer life. Okay.
Yeah.
You don't have something because you don't ask.
Yeah.
You know, and again, we're going to go out and get it. We're going to go, you know, but basic communication here, not only ourselves to God, but ourselves to others. Or when you ask, you don't get it because you're asking for the wrong reason. I've always, you know, kind of remember that, thinking, well, that's good. I can think of some prayers in my lifetime that I've just beseeched God and thought, oh, I need this. Be careful. Understand why you're asking, what you're wanting. It helps you get in touch with, I guess, maybe your heart, which probably is one of the main purposes I've learned for prayer.
Yes.
It's not that we have to convince God what we need or what we want. Most often for me, it's spending that time with God. I get clearer on where my heart's coming from and what's going on in my head. Submitting to God is not sort of this master-slave kind of thing that some people maybe want to make it. It's opening yourself to God. Draw near, and you'll find God drawing near to you.
Bad behavior, you know, kind of flows out of envy, ambition, and the cravings inside of us,
as
James says. And to find this other, first you got to deal with you before you deal with outside. There's two lines come to mind. Well, there's kind of the Buddhist saying that goes something like this. To make peace, first you have to be peace. I think draw near to God and God will draw near to you. You get into the center of that and you get into that peace and you let go of this envy and ambition and that sort of thing, and you begin. And then those kind of things that you are desiring, the gentleness and the cravings, will begin to grow. The other line that comes to mind is Solzhenitsyn's line about the line between good and evil. We're always trying to draw the line between good and evil. And he says it doesn't go between people and between nations. The line between good and evil goes right down the middle of every human heart. And the battle is within before it's without. And we have to seek to bury the envies and cravings that are war within us. And then we will find peace between us.
Let's finish up with some gospel today. Jesus is still literally walking the disciples through some This is the pretty tough territory. Again, we saw last week, we've had this turn in the gospel story as Mark is laying it out. And Jesus is heading towards Jerusalem. Things are very resolute and in terms of counting the cost and what's really going to happen here. And we see the disciples still struggling with this whole getting killed and being raised again. And you know, they don't understand. And so let's look at this gospel story.
Well, I want to say, first of all, verse 32 pretty much sums up my higher education. He did not understand what he was saying and were afraid to ask. Yeah. I spent most of my life after class talking to other people saying, what was that all about?
There you go.
So I'm sure I identify with them a little bit. One of the things I want to mention is in verse 33, what were you arguing about on the way? And that's not a throwaway line.
No.
Mark, throughout the gospel, this image of on the way should be, the way should be capitalized. He's not talking about on the road or just on the road or this. He's talking about on the way of Christianity, on the way of following Christ, on the way to the cross. For Mark, it's all and early on in Acts, you know, Christianity begins, they start talking about the way.
The way.
The way of Christ. And so, you know, this bleeds back. Mark's written, you know, 30, 40 years after Christ, whatever exactly. And so, therefore, this is language that has grown up in the church. And Paul, Mark, the writer of Mark, is using it advisedly. So this is very rich, this whole arguing about on the way. And I one question we could ask ourselves, what are we arguing about on the way? I talked earlier a little bit about the discussion about how open is the table. It seems like the church has always got something to argue about on the way.
Yeah, ain't that the truth?
And sometimes the issue is not the issue, and what we're arguing about is who's the greatest. We might say we're arguing about this, that, or the other theological principle, but at some level, we have to ask ourselves, if we're a part of that conversation, that argument, we have to ask ourselves, am I arguing for my own greatness, or is this an important concern? So there's that. So this really is, Mark keeps playing in this Mark and pivot, you know, this turn toward Jerusalem, face like flint, I'm going, and he's telling everybody, this train is going. You thought it was going to glory, it's going to the cross. It may end up at glory, but it's got to go through the cross. And this is where this goes. And Mark's, you know, this is several times Jesus tries to tell them and people don't get it, which I think indicates to me that it's always been hard. We're so used to in the church the whole issue of the cross and suffering and death and resurrection that we don't take it as seriously as we should. I think that's a question. I think we leap from Palm Sunday to Easter, always and forever.
We much prefer to get saved and then talk about glory. You know, let's just go on to heaven. And all along the way is a whole different matter. I think you're right to point out here, that is a key phrase, this whole idea of on the way. And this is a process. And there's I think we can even lean into the fact that they're walking along the way. I mean, this is the real details of real gritty life.
They were walking, and I have no doubt this argument actually took place. Mm-hmm. You know, and what's interesting, you look at this middle section of Mark, and look at how many times this early creed, and I will use the word advisedly, this statement of the faith goes, he says it over and over. And this is, I think, for the early church, they're trying to say, this is the key. It's not just resurrection. It was betrayed, killed. 3 days after being killed, he will rise again. And it says to me, one thing is that death and resurrection has been no easier to believe then than it is now. I mean, some people recently go, well, you know, they were easy to fool, or they were susceptible to this magical thinking. No, they knew when people died, they didn't come back.
Right.
So this is a hard story, and they're really trying to say, this is what this is about, this death and resurrection, and following is about going along with that. It's not about being great. So there's that. The discipleship, suffering equals the cross. this is a great irony. They didn't understand. How often do we seek to claim the victory of Easter and avoid the demands of the cross? I think that's an important question as you preach this day. How often do we try to claim the goodness that comes from being a part of the church and that while avoiding the demands of the cross? Fred Craddock said, just think about the fact there are 3 overflowing services on Easter.
Yeah.
How many people show up on Good Friday?
Right. I was just thinking the same thing. And all you have to do is look at attendance on Easter. And to a degree, even Palm Sunday. I mean, that's kind of cool, you know.
Yeah.
March in, kids, and all that kind of stuff. But boy, Holy Week services? Not so much. Not so much, yeah. That's it.
So I think this is a good time to talk about that, the discipleship issues.
Yeah.
This is a good time to talk about servanthood versus leadership and being servant, first and last and servant, et cetera. That's the push here.
And I want to talk about something intriguing you raised in the introduction and a possibility for bringing this all together. Because, again, right. We don't hear this easily. It doesn't matter what time of the year you preach these kinds of things. And that's this passage closing with the image of the child.
Right.
And what a brilliant move, first of all, by Jesus. And how do we bring into this ways that we might discuss this, along the way and the cost and what's important and all the things we've talked about today by doing as Jesus did and bring the image of the child here into the into the midst of it. Any thoughts on that?
Well, you know, the thing they're talking about is who's the greatest, mm-hmm. you know, and then they're talking about when you come into your, in different contexts, it's who's going to sit at your right and left hand when you come into your kingdom. So they're all thinking adult stuff.
Right.
And they're talking about power. And, you know, children were, it didn't matter in this culture, mm-hmm. you know, in Roman culture, up until you were the age, whatever it was, I started to say 18, but I'm not sure that's exact right. But whenever you were, up until you were an adult. The father could kill you and nothing anybody could do about it. You were his property.
Right.
They have Roman soldiers riding home to a pregnant wife saying, if it's a boy, da-da-da-da-da. If it's a girl, take her out and put her on a rock. Just casually. So just know, they didn't practice that in Jewish society. But the children were not terribly significant. And so the train here is when he says, whoever welcomes a child in my name welcomes me, and whoever welcomes me welcomes not me, but the one who sent me. This is a more of that radical upside downness. He's saying God is like a child. I'm turning this. You're looking up here. Down here is where it is. It's turned upside down. And that's what he's doing with this. I sometimes joke that Jesus invented, this is the first children's sermon with the child as the object. He takes a child, he sets him in, now look, you know how we always bring object lessons? Here's his object lesson. This is God. This is what you're aspiring to. The first shall be last. So now, what does he mean by, the kind of innocence and serving others? Oh, this is, if we serve a child, we're serving God? Yes. That's the issue.
And I don't know, I hadn't fully thought this out, but as I finished thinking about this for this week, where are the children in our world?
Yeah.
I mean, we have children, and you know, children suffer greatly still in this world.
Yeah.
But there are many who suffer in this world. And again, we've been talking about issues. It's still a hot topic with, refugees and others fleeing and looking and the world having to confront, what in the world do we do with these people?
I think that picture that everybody's talking about the 3-year, the kid who died,
right.
I think that was a great place to start. I mean, we're shifted into how do you preach this, and I think that's a good thing. But I think that's a place to start, is talking about the refugees and the children, and saying where is God, and where do we be great? Well, where we be great is by serving the children, by serving the least of these, by serving those in need, rather than standing at this triumphant place. We serve. We find ourselves at the servant place. That's the point of lifting up the child. The child has to be served. The child has to be taken care of.
Yep.
And that's where you find God, is where you're serving and taking care of needs.
Yep. Well, plenty of stuff for y'all to think about.
Yep.
And Yeah, work on and preach, but there's a lot of opportunity in the text for today, as always. Bubba, as we're about ready to get out of here, I just want to let everybody know we have been working feverishly, one might say, on the release of our new volume, Lectionary Lab Commentary, with stories and sermons for year C. We're trying to get it out a little earlier this year. We had hoped to have it out this week, but looks like we're pushed back to about an October 1st release date. But all of you that have taken advantage of that before, we appreciate it. And those of you that might want to think about it for this coming year, we'll have every Sunday in the lectionary represented there, even those that we might not, text we might not actually read in the coming year. They're all going to be there. And it's just what it says, commentary, stories, sermons, just a handy resource for preachers. That'll be available on Amazon in print form and also in Kindle. Form. So we're working on it, aren't we, Bubba?
We are. It'll be there.
All right.
It'll be there.
All right. All right. Well, I don't reckon much left for us to do today, Bubba, other than to tell everybody bye.
Everybody bye.
Lectionary Lab Live is a Two Bubbas and a Bible production. Our opening theme is Mama Told Me by Frank Anea. We go out this session with All to Jesus I Surrender, words by Judson W. Van Deventer, tuned by Winfield Wheaton, performed by the Vineyard Worship Team.
I surrender all to Him. All to Jesus.